Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello and welcome to Living History, an exciting episode today. We're talking about something that I think is a little bit unexpected. We're talking about soldiers who were trapped behind enemy lines, not during the Second World War, but during the First World War. And I tell you what, when I first started learning about this topic, I didn't even realize this was a thing. I didn't even realize that First World War soldiers could become trapped behind enemy lines. It's an absolutely fascinating subject. To tell us all about it, we've got John Anderson, who wrote a fantastic book about this called Trapped Behind Enemy Lines. And John is one of our great battlefield historians who leads tours for us in France. He lives in the Somme region. He's joining us now on the phone. He's going to tell us all about this fascinating chapter of history. John, thank you for coming on the program.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
Mate, I'm going really, really well. I'm looking forward to this subject because, as I said, I was one of the people out there that I'm sure, like my listeners, who didn't even realize this was a thing. So basically what we're talking about here, the overview is, we're talking about British soldiers who early in the war became trapped during the German advance behind those German lines and were harboured by civilians. Have I summed that up correctly?
Yeah, pretty much so, Matt. I think the first time we discussed this was in a hotel in Gallipoli, if I'm right.
I think that was probably right. You've done a lot of research on the topic, and it's just such a fascinating topic. Give us an overview, John. Tell us what period of the war we're talking about and how these men came to be trapped behind the German lines.
It was right at the beginning of the war, Matt, from the Battle of Mons. The French were retreating from the right flank. The British were being literally overwhelmed eventually with the sheer scale of the German advance. And they had to start retreating, moving back to try to disengage from the Germans. And as they were retreating from Mons, many were wounded, many were worn out, hungry, tired. And some of these guys became separated from their battalions. Some of them managed to get back to join the battalions, but others became completely separated, lost, tired, wounded, and eventually some of them were captured, some were taken in by local people.
So these are British soldiers who came over to France very early in the war and participated in some of these earliest battles, weren't they?
Yeah, these were the initial wave of soldiers that came across and fought at the Battle of Mons.
Tell me a little bit about the civilians, John, that will eventually feature pretty prominently in this story. What was life like for civilians under German occupation during the First World War?
Well, it was pretty tough, Matt, because the Germans had a very strict regime. Particularly in the area that we're going to get to talk about, round about Le Cateau, it's not that far from the German and British front lines in places like the Somme and Arras and that sort of area. So the regime was fairly strict. The Germans registered everybody. Everybody had to have identity cards. Houses were searched. The Germans would requisition virtually anything they wanted. They were searching for contraband, any additional food that people may have been storing up. They also actually registered every farm animal So every chicken, every cow, every sheep, they were all kept in a register, and farmers weren't allowed to slaughter animals without direct permission from the Germans. So it was total control. One of the main problems is because they weren't that far away from the battlefield areas, the Germans were also concerned that if the fighting went against the Germans, if the British and the French pushed forward, you've got all of these civilians that could rise up and help the Allies. And of course, any soldiers that were amongst them were trained soldiers. They may still have hidden weapons. So the Germans were pretty frantic trying to find these fugitives that were behind the lines.
How severe was the occupation compared to what we know about the stories of the Second World War?
I suppose it was the same in some ways, but different in many ways. The Germans were constantly on the lookout for any kind of smuggling. I'll give you an example. It was a capital offence during the First World War for any civilian to have a pigeon.
To have a pigeon?
A capital offence. To have a pigeon. The Germans were worried about communication between the civilian population and the Allies, and pigeons could be used to send messages. So it was a capital offence to have a pigeon. Now, the French eat pigeons. Many of them had sort of dovecots and places where pigeons would roost. They would breed them. They would use them for food. So it was quite a big thing. I'll give you an example of something that happened. There was a guy called Cyril Goss, who was a suspected smuggler. So the Germans were keeping a bit of an eye on these people. And he and his wife, Leanne, the Germans went to their home to have a search for any contraband. And they'd gone on horseback. And as they came back out of the Goss house, Madame Goss saw that the horses had been chewing at her plants that she'd just planted outside. So there was quite an argument, a row ensued. The Germans hadn't found anything, any contraband at that stage, but they were getting into a heated situation. And as this argument was going on, a pigeon was seen to fly into the loft of this house. So the Germans used that as an excuse. They arrested them for having pigeons, and they were both executed. They were the first people in Lakato to be executed.
It's just shocking. I mean, what was some of the penalties? I imagine the penalties for harbouring British men and foreign combatants were pretty severe by the Germans. What did the Germans do to prevent civilians from harbouring Allied soldiers?
Well, there was regular checks on premises. They could come in unannounced and search the property. One of the soldiers I'm going to talk about is a guy called David Cruikshank. He was a Scotsman. He was with the 1st Cameronians, the Scottish Rifles, and he was hidden by a lady called Julie Celestine Bodwin. And on a number of occasions, her property was searched. Now, there weren't just searches that were going on. There was actually German soldiers billeted in the homes of a lot of these civilians. They weren't billeted in the Celestine household, the Bodwin household, but there were a number of searches. One of the searches, the Germans burst in unannounced, and the soldier managed to run up into the loft before they got into the house. Madame Bodwin kind of delayed them as best she could. He climbed into the loft, and the loft in these houses didn't have any dividing walls in them. So he managed to sort of run through the loft, three houses further down the street, and drop down into that house and hid in the cellar while the Germans were there. The Germans insisted on checking the loft. They checked every part of the house. And in the loft, they found the bed that Cruikshank had been sleeping in, together with boxes that were arranged to kind of hide the bed. So they began to question Madame Bodwin, why is this bed here? This is very suspicious. She had a son called Leon, and she said, Leon likes to sleep here. He's got a bed in the bedroom downstairs, but he's got strange fads, and he sometimes likes to sleep up here in the loft. So why are the boxes around him? And she said, well, sometimes he's a little bit strange. He likes a bit of solitude. He likes to sort of hide himself away. And she also said, well, you know, I'm hoping that my husband and my eldest son, Jules, both called Jules, might come home on leave. So we've got this like as a spare bed as well. The German said, Madame Bodwin, this is very, very suspicious. We're going to keep an eye on you.
It's just an incredible story, John. How did before we get we're going to talk obviously about individual men, because it's just absolutely captivating, some of their tales. But how did you come across this story in the first place?
Well, my wife and I are very keen on visiting Brabant, sort of street fairs, bric-a-brac sales, that kind of thing. And we went up to a place called Etap, which was a very famous place during the First World War. There was huge training grounds there. So we went up to this Brabant. Now, the French are very canny. If they tell you that it's going to start at 8 o'clock, you need to be there by 6 o'clock, because that's when the traders and the dealers are setting up and whatever. So we're there about 6 o'clock in the morning, and we're wandering around, and my wife, Kathleen, got her eye on this thing, and it had the Daily Telegraph written on it. And she thought, that's a bit odd in France. Go across and have a look at this thing and see what it is. So I sort of tiptoed around all the junk and the vases and the glassware that were on the ground. And I got up to this thing and picked it up and started to have a look at it. Just as the dealer got to me, and my French isn't brilliant, but I more or less understand. He said, this is very rare. It might even be unique, and this and the other. So he quoted me a price. And while I was trying to think of how to knock him down a bit, try to get a bit of discount, he said, but for you, I'll do it for however many euros it was. It wasn't very much. So I bought this thing, and it turned out to be a beautifully handwritten calligraphy, handwritten and illuminated scroll. And it was saying that this scroll was presented to Madame Julie Celestine Bodwin. It went on to say about how she'd saved a Scottish soldier. There was a beautifully drawn badge of the Cameronians on it, all beautifully coloured in. But it didn't give the name of the soldier. So it took a little while for me to work out who the soldier was. And again, it was my wife, Kathleen, that said, can you remember a book called Foreign Field? I think it was called Foreign Fields by Ben McIntyre. She said, I'm sure there was some mention of soldiers that were looked after by French civilians in that. In fact, the whole book's about that. We had a copy of it, so we were flicking through the pages, and we found this name, Julie Celestine Bodwin, and she protected a soldier called David Cruikshank. So that was the start of the research. I got in touch with the Cameronians Museum in Hamilton. They were very, very helpful, and they sent me some documents in French from a French local history magazine that went out. So I had those translated by someone out here, and the story began to unfold. It was about how this young Glaswegian guy had joined the army in February of 1914. He'd gone off to fight at the Battle of Mons, and he'd been separated from his regiment, was taken in by Julie Celestine Bodwin and her family. And then from there, further research led me to other soldiers who had also been trapped.
Well, John, let's talk about some of them specifically. Let's talk about Mr. Cruikshank. He was the first one you mentioned. Just tell us his story. How did he come to be in her care, and what happened to him during the course of the war?
Okay, he joined the army in February of 1914. Just a few months before the war was due to start. At that stage, he was just 18-year-old. And he went off with his battalion to the Battle of Mons. And they came under pretty heavy fire. And during the retreat from Mons, he became exhausted and separated from the rest of his battalion. The battalion were falling back into a place called Le Cateau. And to get there, there was a couple of problems with that area. The ground wasn't great. They were faced with this huge forest of Montmartre. Brigades and divisions had to separate and go around this forest. So there was a lot of confusion. Guys, David had said, was wounded, exhausted. And he found himself in Le Cateau on the morning of the 26th of August, 1914, just as the British Army were moving back from Le Cateau to make a stand just behind there to try to hold the Germans off. So as David is in the streets of Le Cateau, the Germans are beginning to occupy the town. The Battle of Le Cateau is in full swing. And David's simply lost and alone. He's by now he's just 19. He's only had a few months of basic training, so he's not an experienced soldier. And can you imagine what it must have been like to be in the streets of a strange town with groups of Germans occupying the town? They'd literally shoot at anything that moved. And David was faced with a group of Germans. He was spotted by a group of Germans who fired at him. He said, fortunately, most of the bullets missed. I think one grazed him a bit. So he started running down this street. And as he's running down the street, he gets partway down the street, and another group of Germans block off the bottom end of the street and start shooting at him. So David does the only thing he can think of. He throws himself onto the ground as though he's been shot dead, and he just lies as still as he. Fortunately, the Germans were far too busy advancing through the town to worry about checking him. They just thought they'd shot him and he was down. And as they moved off, there's two stories or two versions of the story as to how he met Madame Bodwin. The first one says that he went to the door of the house where Madame Bodwin was sort of looking out of the door to see what was going on, and he pleaded with her to take her in, to take him in and look after him. She herself, her husband, and her eldest son Jules were away fighting the war with the French forces, and she thought, if my son should find himself in these kind of circumstances, I would want the person that found him to take him in and care for him. So that's what she did. She took him in and she started looking after him. The other version, told by David a few years later, was that he ran through an alleyway between the houses and hid in the garden. And then
millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Walked his way into the cellar of Madame Bodwin's house. And he said that there was beer on the table, wine and beer. So he was very thirsty, so he had a drink. And then he heard footsteps coming down into the cellar. So he pointed his rifle at these approaching footsteps. And Madame Bodwin appeared. I don't know what she would have thought, having a British soldier aiming a rifle at her. But it must have been a scary moment for her. But either way, whichever is true, Madame Bodwin took him in. It was a very courageous and dangerous thing to do because, of course, being found to be hiding a fugitive, the rules were very strict, that there was a strong possibility that she could have been executed for hiding this British soldier. But she decided to take him in despite the risks. She cleaned him up. She tended to his wounds. But he needed a bit more care than she could give him, a bit more medical care to get him back on his feet. So there was a local doctor called Pierre Tyson that she trusted with the secret of David being hidden there. Initially, he was hidden in a little hut at the bottom of the garden that was kind of overgrown with ivy and stuff like that. But eventually, he was brought into the house, and they had a little hiding place built in the loft for him.
And what happened to him over the course of the next weeks and months, John?
After this period of rest and building his strength up again, he was going mad in the confines of this small house. Of course, it was very, very dangerous to go out into the streets because of the German patrols, because somebody might see him and recognize him and you realize he's a German soldier. But they managed to get him some sort of workman's clothes. And he and Julie Celestine's son, Leon, once it was dark, would go out into the back streets and have a little bit of a wander around just to get some exercise. But this was never going to be enough for David. So someone had the idea of dressing him up as a woman. He was only 19. He said he didn't have much of a beard. He was fairly fresh-faced. So one of the neighbours, a girl called Amy Olivier, had become quite friendly with David. She used to bring him sweets and cigarettes and things. And it's thought that she had the idea of dressing him up as a woman. So they got clothes from various places, and a cousin of Julie Celestine Bodman was a hairdresser, so he managed to acquire a wig. So David got himself all dressed up in these women's clothes and came into the living room where two or three people were. And he said, "What do you think?" And Amy said, "Well, David, you look like a woman, but you act like a man." So she took it upon herself to teach David how to act more in much more feminine way, if you like, hand gestures, head movements, that sort of thing. And one of the things she did was she got a length of string and tied his ankles together so that he couldn't take a long stride when he was walking. And after a period of practice, he kind of got into this way of acting in a more feminine way. Together, David and Amy would go out onto the streets of Lakato, first when it was almost dark, but then they became more and more brave about what they were doing, more confident in what they were doing. And it wasn't unusual for David and Amy to be wandering around the streets of Lakato in daylight, just walking past German patrols.
How long was David harboured by the family for?
Well, they took him in on the 26th of September 1914, and it was September of 1916 when he was eventually captured by the Germans. He had been betrayed. David tells a story that when he was running through the streets of Lakato during the Battle of Lakato in August of 1914, he sheltered in a doorway, and there was another woman sheltering in the doorway who got a good look at him. He calls her Madame D. Her true name is not known. But eventually, when he was out and about, and he was kind of known as Mademoiselle Louise, he was spotted by this woman who knew that he was a British soldier. And she started making romantic advances towards him, if you like. But David repulsed these advances. He wasn't interested. And at one stage, she said to David, "I know who you are. I could betray you." A few days went past and nothing happened. So they thought it was just an idle threat of some kind. However, one night, the Germans burst into the Bodwin household, ran straight upstairs into a bedroom where David actually was in bed with Leon. They were sharing a bed at that stage. They pulled the blankets back off the bed to reveal David lying in the bed. And they knew they'd caught their British soldier. So David and Madame Bodwin were taken to the cellar of a local convent that was being used by the Germans at that stage as a headquarters. They were locked up in the cellar of this convent, and eventually came the day for a tribunal, a court case. They were brought in front of German officers who were acting as judge and jury, effectively. The evidence was laid before this tribunal, and David swore that he'd never left the house, that he wasn't a spy, he just stayed in the house all the time. But the Germans wouldn't believe what he was saying. So he was sentenced to death. At this stage, Madame Bodwin, who was in the tribunal room, made an impassioned plea to the Germans. She said, my husband and my son are fighting with the French army. I have no word of them. Please don't take this young man away from me. The Germans went back and checked their records and came back to Madame Bodwin and said, well, your husband is a prisoner of war and your son was killed in September of 1914. So she continued with this plea. She says, please, please, this war has taken away my son. God has sent me this young Scotsman in his place. Please don't kill him. So they actually commuted his sentence to imprisonment.
And what happened to Madame Bodwin herself?
She was sent to prison too, a place called Siegburg, where there were other women from the district who had been protecting soldiers. They weren't treated very well. It was a working prison, so you were expected to work. There were rumours that the prison guards were pretty ferocious. In fact, it said Madame Bodwin lost a couple of teeth when she was being knocked about at one stage. So she was sent to prison for the rest of the war. David was in prison also. In fact, the first his family knew that he was alive was a photograph of David that was taken while he was in prison. Apparently these prisons had photographers and various other services, and they would sort of barter for their services. And the photograph's like a postcard-sized photograph of David in a quite bizarre mixture of uniforms. And a friend of ours, Peter Smith, had a look at this photograph, and he said, the photographers worked in these prisons, and they would have bits of uniform that they could dress these prisoners up in to make them look more military than they would have otherwise. And this photograph was taken in prison, and it was sent by David to his family in Glasgow, and that was the first word the family had that he was still alive. Because having gone missing on the 26th of August, 1914, David would then have been presumed killed in action.
And so presumably he survived captivity and survived the war.
Yeah, I mean, he was released from prison. The war ended, as you know, 11th of November 1918, but it required quite a bit of effort to arrange transport and what have you for all of these prisoners of war and people who were in prison. And David was released in December of 1918. He had to go back to Glasgow, to his family and his regiment. And then I'm not quite sure how he managed to do it, but by February of 1919, he'd made his way back to Lakato. And on the 12th of February 1919, David was married to Amy Olivier, the girl who had dressed him up and who had helped to save him.
That's absolutely extraordinary. And tell me about the rest of their lives. Did they stay in France? Did they go back to England?
Well, David started off working for the Imperial War Graves Commission, as it was then. But I think there were some rule changes where there was only a certain number of foreigners that were allowed to work in France at that time. So he left the Imperial War Graves Commission. And interestingly enough, I've been in touch with a member of his family, a guy called Glenn Cruikshank. That was quite an amazing discussion that Glenn and I had. Glenn said that they moved to Paris and decided to run a bar. But it didn't work out very well because David was drinking all of the profits. One of the stories that Glenn came up with was that David was quite a bit of a lad, and he'd gone out his day and he'd come back to the bar and his wife Amy with two lion cubs, which he kept in the house. But Amy said he had to get rid of them because they kept ripping the furniture and tearing the curtains down. Eventually, David wanted to move back to Scotland, so David and Amy gave up the bar and went back to Glasgow, but Amy just couldn't settle there. She didn't like it at all. So eventually, they moved to a place called Stroud or Stroud in Gloucestershire, and they lived there for the rest of their lives.
John, it's just such an extraordinary story of David Cruikshank. Do we know if he kept in touch with the French family in the years after the war?
Yes, he did. Unfortunately, there seems to have been a bit of a falling out between Julie Celestine Bodwin and David Cruikshank, because she wasn't on the guest list of the wedding when David and Amy were married. So there's been some kind of falling out there. And also another part of the story was involves a trip to London. A few years after the war, in 1927, in fact, General Louis Spears, who was liaison officer between the British and the French, was touring the old battlefields. And somebody told him about these French heroines who had saved British soldiers during the Great War, hidden them and protected them, and how they were now living as paupers. They had nothing. They were in a very poor state. The housing wasn't very good. So Louis Spears got in touch with Lord Burnham, who then was the owner of the Daily Telegraph in London. And Lord Burnham sent a reporter out to interview these women, one of which was Julie Celestine Bodwin. They printed the stories about these women over a week in the Telegraph, and there was an incredible response to these stories going out. One of the stories was the story of David Cruikshank and Madame Bodwin, another soldier, Herbert Hull, who had been taken in by the Cardon family in Bertry. Sadly, he was also betrayed, but he was executed. There was the story about Patrick Fowler. Patrick Fowler was an interesting guy. He was hidden in a wardrobe for 4 years by the Belmont-Gobert family. He survived the war. But these stories appeared in the Daily Telegraph, and the response was phenomenal. People writing in, how can we help these people? So the Daily Telegraph set up a fund, a charitable fund for people to send them money. And they, back in those days, they raised an enormous amount of money. It was something like £3,500, which in 1927 was a lot of money. So the Daily Telegraph decided that they would do something official with these women. With the money that they'd raised, they would buy annuities, pensions for these people. And they decided to bring them to London to present them with these annuities. So they came to London in April of 1927, and they were feted all over the place. They went to London Zoo, they went to the theatre, and they went to the Mansion House in London, where they were presented with these testimonials, these beautifully handwritten testimonials by the Lord Mayor of London. They were given these annuities. Julie Celestine Bodwin and Madame Cardon were awarded the Allied Subject Medal, sometimes known as the Prisoner of War Helpers Medal, and the two Belmont-Gobert women were awarded the MBE. At the end of the commemoration, at the end of the trip, they were invited to Windsor Castle to have tea with the King and Queen.
John, do we know how many men in total were saved by French civilians?
No, there's no definitive number. Some of these guys managed to escape across the border after a fairly short time before the Germans tightened all the controls down. Those that were left behind, there were 11 soldiers that were being protected by Monsieur Chalandre. They were being hidden in an inn, in a mill rather, in a place called Iran, and they were betrayed, they were captured, and the 11 soldiers and Monsieur Chalandre were executed by the Germans. It's the largest mass execution of British forces in the First World War.
Well, John, it's just such a gripping tale, and you tell in much greater detail in your book. Tell us a little bit about the book, Trapped Behind Enemy Lines.
Yeah, it's a joint effort by myself and a guy called Victor Puke. I've done a fair bit of research on this story, and Vic is a former journalist, and we used to get together and play guitars and mess around, and we would chat about this story and these soldiers that were trapped. So Vic just one day said, right, look, why don't we just get our heads down and get this all written down and get a book written. So we did over a period of a couple of years. We did a bit of extra research and got it published in 2014, I think it was, about 6 years ago now.
Well, it's a fascinating story, John, and people can look out for that book, Trapped Behind Enemy Lines, and to learn more about it, because it's just such an interesting chapter of the First World War that we don't know very much about. Thank you so much for taking the time to tell us about it today.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.